powerful media figures in America, and that's because President Trump is part of his audience. Trump watches a ton of Fox News. He frequently live tweets the segments that he takes a shine to. He also gets advice from Fox hosts directly. And more often than not recently, that's been Tucker Carlson, from strikes against Iran to the coronavirus to more recently his attacks on Black Lives Matter and protests. Tucker Carlson's commentary is shaping the president's responses to the events that are happening around us. It's very dangerous.
I want to thank you, Matt Gaetz, for being with us. Now, Tucker Carlson says he's gone trout fishing. Matt Gaetz is senior fellow at Media Matters. We'll link to your latest piece, Tucker Carlson Has Said Enough. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
That's true. KBOO Portland, where the time is 8 a.m. on a Tuesday morning. And as regular listeners know, this is time for the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on your community connection, KBOO. Stay tuned.
Joe, that's Abe. I just want to tell everyone this is KBOO 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. We all want to remind you that the station is still alive and well and definitely needs your support. And this is the Abe and Joe Show. That's Abe Proctor. I'm Joe Uris. And we have a guest today. Abe, what's the story?
Yeah, we're going to be joined in a little while by KBOO's own Alex Solomon. Alex is a reporter, volunteer here with KBOO, who has been involved in covering the ongoing protests in downtown, and also has been involved with the city's police oversight committee. So Alex is going to talk about both of those things. But before we go to our guests, I want to set the stage a little bit today. Those of you who've been following the protests here in Portland know that it's become a steadily degenerating situation in terms of repeated violent face-offs between the police and protesters. And when I say violent face-offs, I mean violence from the police. That is what I'm talking about. This past weekend, Saturday night, a young man named Donovan LaBella, a protester down at the Justice Center downtown, was shot in the head by a so-called less lethal projectile from an as-yet unnamed and unidentified federal agent emerging from the Justice Center. These less lethal rounds that I'm talking about, and I use that term advisedly because has there ever in the history of oxymorons been a bigger oxymoron than less lethal? These are the rubber bullets, the wooden bullets, the beanbag rounds that police and others use, deploy sometimes as crowd control measures. There's a lot of controversy surrounding the use of these weapons. Not least of which because of their silly Orwellian name, but because, as in the case of Mr. LaBella, they can cause serious injury and even death. So they're far from less lethal, the rounds. So a little background on what happened. There was what has become a more or less standard face-off unfolding down at the Justice Center. Mr. LaBella was a protester on the scene holding above his head a speaker, presumably with which to amplify the words of his fellow protesters. A tear gas canister was fired across the street towards the protesters. It landed near Mr. LaBella, He returned it toward the federal agents. And then almost immediately after, he was shot in the temple by this less lethal round. There's a video of this. You can find it in a number of news outlets around town. The Oregonian has footage. Oregon Public Broadcasting has the footage. I believe we have it at the cable site as well. It's horrifying. It's horrifying. This young man drops to the ground immediately, as if he's been shot in the head, because he just was shot in the head. There's a panic that ensues briefly. His fellow protesters get it together pretty quickly, surround him and pick up his body and remove it from the scene. At that point, he was lying in a substantial pool of his own blood. He has since received reconstructive surgery to his face and part of his skull. He's still in intensive care, but thankfully is now responsive to physicians. I mentioned earlier the involvement, apparently, of the U.S. Marshal's Office. The fact is that we really don't know for sure which federal agency was responsible for the shooting or how that person ended up in front of the Justice Center in downtown Portland on Saturday night. We know that the president has made repeated threats to send in first the army until his aides told him no, he couldn't actually do that, and then armed federal agents to various cities around the nation where protests have been flaring up in an attempt to crack down on protesters. He has repeated that call even after Mr. LaBella was shot here in Portland. Just yesterday, the president said on camera that the federal government may, quote, take over cities to combat rising crime. Quote, numbers are going to be coming down even if we have to go and take over cities. So there seems to be at least a high degree of probability here that this officer was sent to the scene by the Federal Justice Department, and one might infer instructed to use this sort of force against protesters. Now, something I want to focus on here for just a minute. I mentioned that Mr. LaBella was shot in the temple. I'm not an expert on deploying this sort of less lethal ammunition, impact munitions, as they're colloquially known. But I'm willing to bet a substantial sum of money that you're not supposed to take aim and shoot somebody in the head. We're talking about a trained professional, this agent, who shot Mr. LaBella in the head. I'm assuming that this agent is a man. And I'm assuming also this man has been trained in the use of this weaponry that he was deploying. He's a good shot. He can hit what he's aiming at. And I can only conclude that he was aiming at Mr. LaBella's head. Now, why would you do that, even with if you're operating with a so-called less lethal munition? Why would you do that unless you're trying to seriously injure or kill the person you're aiming at? So again, I encourage people to watch these videos, and I have to warn you, they're difficult. They're very difficult to watch. But we live in an age of videos that are difficult to watch. Something has to happen here. This sort of ongoing standoff with these types of results, it's just not acceptable. This at long last managed to jolt Mayor Ted Wheeler out of his silence, his conspicuous silence around these ongoing protesters. And he released over the weekend a rather milquetoast series of tweets about how he's calling on the federal government to be transparent with their findings. He's calling on federal law enforcement agencies to find better solutions. This is too little too late and nowhere near enough from our mayor. At any point during this unfolding series of confrontations, the mayor could have drawn a bright line between the Portland Police Bureau and these federal agents who have been interacting with citizens in a violent way. And there's a layer of irony on top of this all too, because right now the Portland Police Bureau is operating under an injunction handed down by a judge in response to a lawsuit filed by a number of journalists in Portland. This orders the police bureau to desist from using violent means to interact with crowds at these protests. So the Portland Police Bureau is effectively shackled while the feds are able to use all these tactics that the Portland Police Bureau was recently instructed to set aside. And so we've seen night after night here when federal agents move into an area to clear out protesters, they are often accompanied by Portland police, who, while they may not be deploying these sorts of munitions and tactics themselves, are there in support, marching right alongside the federal agents. So when the mayor calls upon all these people for a more rational and compassionate response, I say, Ted, you could have at any time ordered your officers to stay away from these federal agents, to not support them in any way, to not even give the impression that you are condoning or assisting with them in the use of these potentially deadly tactics in any way. But the mayor did none of those things. And here we are. Do you have anything to add to that, Joe?
Yeah, I do. I want to do a speculation here, and I hope people won't resent it, but it makes, to me, grim sense. If everybody remembers, President, can't even say it, the leader, the great leader, Trump, in order to impress us all, had the protesters in Lafayette Park cleared by a line of Cossacks, you know, horsemen with clubs, several lines of unlabeled police agents of some agency or other, and these were all using very brutal tactics to clear away the crowd, so that the president could go in front of a church into which he has never gone, certainly not to pray, and where he held up a Bible, unfortunately upside down, but hell, it's okay, and a book I'm almost certain he has never read, and used that as a prop to support his law and order and God's on my side notions. That event, which was really, really bizarre, and in any other time in history would be much more remarked on as a weird thing, also involved a large number of unlabeled but law enforcement wearing outfit guys who we were told, at least on NBC, were probably prison beatdown guards. And these guys, the term beatdown, relates to the fact these are the people that are brought into federal prisons to break up prison riots. They are always, they don't have name tags, they don't have any identification except the uniform and the weapon they use, which usually is a big stick, and they just beat the hell out of prisoners who've been resisting being prisoners in the context of a riot. So I am speculating that these guys include amongst themselves people of that training, that is, trained to deal with violent, angry prisoners and to hurt those prisoners with big clubs. And I really believe that part of that revenge of the president involves sending out to various cities at least some of those guys whose sole, as I understand, sole real occupation is to break the back of any resistance in the prison system. And this seems to me to be so fascistic and so outrageous that we need to find out whether I'm crazy, you know, is this just some crazy speculation, or am I intuitively correct? Because remember, I have no hard evidence. I believe these are the same people that are now starting to use so-called less than lethal weapons on resistors, on pacifists, on people who are objecting to the historic horrors of the American police system.
Now, the question of whether or not you're crazy, Joe, is not going to be resolved by this conversation.
Yeah,
but, I think we have, absent hard evidence, we can't say for sure, but we have every reason to suspect that the officers who have been doling out this violence here in Portland and in other cities around the country are there at the request of the administration and are following tactical instructions handed out by that administration. Okay. Well, that all being said, let's go to the phones and we'll bring on Cable's own Alex Solomon, who can hopefully help illuminate this situation a little better for us. Alex, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Why don't we start? Why don't you tell us sort of generally what you've observed as a journalist on the scene as this protest has unfolded in Portland.
Okay, so just a little caveat. I haven't been on the ground for like 2 weeks, I think. So this is, my experience is limited to the first few weeks of the protest, as I haven't been on the ground for the past couple weeks. So my experience was with PPB and some other state Floyd police. And it was interesting, to say the least. Well, I covered both the East Side protest and the protest downtown at the Justice Center. I found that there was no police presence, as everybody knows, on the East Side, where there were the most numbers. However, a lot of the tactics used by the East Side protesters were much the same on the West Side at the Justice Center, just chanting, singing, you know, eating free snacks, and the like. But the presence of the police made, you know, violent situations occur, basically. So I witnessed a lot of, like, people putting a hole in the fence but then not actually doing anything further with it, and that being used as a reason to deploy officers and disperse the situation with tear gas and rubber bullets. I myself was basically told I needed to go home, even though I was a reporter, and I said repeatedly I was pressed, that I don't care. This is your last warning, after telling me maybe three times in a single evening. By that point, like, crowds had dispersed, and it was like 2 a.m, so I did end up heading home. But I think, I don't know, I guess it's hard to say what, I don't know, I guess it's hard to say, like, what would be a response from the police in the current system that we have, with the current rules that we have, that would actually respond well to the demands of all of the protesters. And that's kind of been, like, made very clear, especially in that Citizens Review Committee meeting I was in yesterday. Mm-hmm. Basically, many questions were asked by citizens about, you know, how we can actually, you know, enforce accountability within the police structure. And over again, the responses were kind of, like, weak. And you can follow individual officer, weak and individual, I guess is how I describe it, and doesn't actually, you know, address the systemic issues that are present here.
So it was your impression in observing the dynamics of the scene. First of all, it sounds like the presence of the police, generally speaking, takes what was an emotionally charged situation and turns it into a potentially incendiary one. You know, that they provide that inflection of confrontational energy. I'm speaking very broadly here. That is enough to turn these situations from peaceful gatherings into not so peaceful gatherings. And it sounds to me also as if you're recognizing that there really isn't an acute solution here beyond simply removing the police. That the problems here are systemic and endemic. And flow from, as you've mentioned, I think this is a really good way to frame this, from the rules that are already in place.
Right, right. Something that is particularly interesting is, I mean, the City Justice, an organization that's been leading the East Side protests until recently, basically they're getting a lot of flack for many things, but particularly from the Justice Center protesters for not even actually standing up to police. So the Justice Center protesters believe they have more clout because they're actually there with the police, chanting at the police and trying to get, you know, answers directly. And meanwhile, Rose City Justice is, like, you know, willing to sit down with commissioners. And I think that the split, it highlights a bigger issue, which is that, you know, no matter what, even if the police left the situation at the Justice Center, if they just, like, disappeared, wouldn't would the protesters feel the same as like the East Side protesters in not actually, you know, talking directly to police? It kind of just seems like, what do we want the outcome to be? Do we want the police to leave? Do we want them to disperse themselves? Because then what? Is it that they're not paying attention anymore?
Yeah, it really causes us to reexamine the very notion of policing and what it means in this context, which I suppose is the entire point of the protest, isn't it? I should mention to people that this is the Ava Joe Talk Radio program on KBOO 90.7 FM. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. We're on the air now with Alex Solomon, a reporter here with KBOO. We're also taking your written comments at our Facebook page, facebook.com/AvaJoe, and also over the Twitter machine at HonestAbe72. Joe, do you have any questions for Alex this morning?
Well, I feel a little handicapped here. I'm not happy with our method of communication, but it's better than none. But I do want to make a little bit of historical understanding of how the police in Portland evolved into the more violent style of policing that they now have. And it all dates back, in terms of encounters with public, to the student strike at Portland State in 1970, when Lieutenant Bure had organized a strike force who had longer clubs and different helmets and so on, and were trained to beat down protesters, not to arrest, but to beat them down. And they went after a crowd which expected to be arrested, resisting a demand that the structure put up in the park blocks at Portland State be allowed to remain. The police demanded that it be removed. Those officers were prepped to hit, to hurt, to smash, and they did, but they were very, very systematic about it. They were very well trained. Nobody, as far as I know, was hurt beyond the minor concussions. That's not to say it wasn't important, not to say that what the police did was a legitimate police activity, since that whole crowd was passively resisting and could have been surrounded and arrested at the time. However, that set a precedent which has evolved into the present situation, where the Portland police see themselves, are probably encouraged to see themselves, as being in charge of breaking up any kind of demonstration at the order of their command structure, or even at the decisions of officers on the, you know, head officers on the ground. That's the precedent, and that's what we're still dealing with. And this is essentially a part and parcel of a very reactionary idea set, which included the fight against African-American independent units, African-Americans struggling for democracy way back then, and being concerned about things like the Vietnam War. So we have a long history of this kind of behavior, and it did, in fact, become worse and worse once the less lethal rounds were used. We saw that in May Day 1999, once those lethal rounds were regularly used and effective, as of course they are, they became standard. It didn't matter that the crowd was or was not violent, which they largely were not. It didn't matter that people shouted ugly words, which they did. It didn't matter that people stood up to the police. All of that was irrelevant. These weapons, because they could disperse for crowd, because they could hurt people, have become normative in Portland, and I don't see that they're needed. I don't understand it. I've been into a few of these things. I don't see that there is any danger to anyone except the police confronting them. I don't understand why, given their numbers, arrests could not be effected if that was the desire of the city. So, you know, we are in a situation which is very typical of every other city as well as Portland, and my big question is, who the hell were these federal guys?
Yeah, that does seem to be a looming question right now. Alex, let me ask you a little more about the Citizens Review Committee in which you just took place. I formally called what the Portland Citizen Review Committee's Forum on Police Oversight and Police Reform. How would you characterize that conversation in that forum, and what, if any, were any resolutions that you saw coming out of it?
Great question. So I think I would characterize the forum as a little bit limp. In that, I think I mentioned this before, it's just that a lot of community members came forward with questions, demanding, you know, to see change. And the answers all very like procedural and slow and not quite answering the questions either. So I think one person asked, basically after I asked my question about name tags, if they could make them larger, basically, or if they are making them larger, which Lovell said that they are, unspecified font size though, so I don't actually know how much larger. He said he's in the process of getting new name tags printed, or new number badges printed, but he's not going to display name tags due to death threats for cops. However, another person asked if he would be willing to display name tags, you know, on the chest as well as the arm and the pant leg, so that they're more easy to read, you know, from further away, especially when you're being chased downtown, in a just very highly, you know, raucous environment. It's very hard to take down a very tiny number when you see misconduct. And, you know, Lovell basically said no, they wouldn't be interested in doing that because it wouldn't be, quote, feasible. So I think, like, feasibility is something that we keep going back to. It's entirely feasible to do just, like, small things that don't cost actually that much money and do increase accountability. However, our system isn't really willing to implement those tactics, especially when, you know, that's against union, police union desires, I guess. So I guess that was one thing that we learned.
No, go ahead, please.
Oh, no, what was that?
Well, I was just going to observe that, you know, I think you're right. In a responsive system, the Citizens Oversight Committee would be making these decisions rather than simply discussing them or making recommendations.
Right. And I mean, there was other points made about how the citizens, you know, the commission doesn't actually, you know, complete any reform because every time, you know, a misconduct claim goes through the system, it basically gets dismissed at some point. I think there was one, it was in the comments section. I think people were, you know, really pretty enraged about it. That there was maybe one instance where a police officer was going to be let go or, you know, punished for something that he did misconduct-wise, and Ted Wheeler ended up just, you know, letting it pass, letting it slide, and nothing actually happened. So you have to ask, like, how effective are the systems we have in place, and what can we replace them with? You know, that's the next question.
Right, exactly. And as our fearless mayor puts it, he says he's calling on the federal government to adhere to the same directives as our Portland Police Bureau when it comes to crowd control munitions. Now, there's a heaping scoop of irony ladled on that, because as we discussed earlier in the program, the only reason the police bureau is not using those same tactics is because they're under an injunction from a federal court.
Right.
So it would seem to me that, you know, you were talking about systemic reform to the police bureau. It seems like we're miles away from that right now. If we can't even get the commissioner in charge of the police bureau, which is our fearless mayor, to offer anything besides, you know, strongly worded tweets calling on other agencies to step up.
Yeah,
it's
absolutely
disappointing.
Well, I want to inject one thing here. The reason why I brought up the events way back in 70 is that was a turning point in the way in which policing of crowds took place, and from that point on, it was simply an escalation of weaponry on the part of the police with so-called less than lethal weaponry, which again we saw in 99, and we've seen it in several instances where there was no real threat to the officers, but they apparently perceived a threat and they wanted to see, and I believe it's a let's see how powerful we are. They wanted to display their power by dispersing people who may, I believe, have been perfectly legitimate, though raucous, demonstrators. This is a pattern that grows and grows and grows. It is also the pattern that has resulted in unnecessary murder, I want to use that term, murder, by the police of persons of color in Portland, not just once, but many times. And it's really, really outrageous. We all have this kind of liberal lines. No, the fact of the matter is the police really, under this system, are virtually out of control.
Yeah, I'd say that's an accurate assessment of the situation. If we could switch gears just a little bit, Alex, I wanted to ask you something about your role as a journalist. Now, I have to say I've been steering largely clear of the protests because I have an immunocompromised individual in my household, and I just haven't judged it to be a safe activity in that regard. So I haven't been able to lay my own eyes on what's been going on, but I have to say that it's the amount of independent journalism out there that is both readily accessible and of a high degree of quality is just stunning. I have to hand it to you and your fellow citizen journalists who are really doing a fine job of bringing into people's homes exactly what's transpiring out there every single night. And it's even reached the point where major news organizations are freely borrowing footage filmed by independent journalists on the scenes in many of these protests around the country. So, you know, even as we are witnessing the untenability of our current policing arrangement and infrastructure in this country, we are only granted that opportunity because of the way independent journalists have been able to bring this to us. So what I want to ask you then in this context is there like a loose network of journalists on the ground here in Portland, and do you guys share information? Do you talk about where you're going to be? Do you discuss ways to keep each other safe? I'm just wondering what sort of community of journalists has arisen here.
Yeah, I think one has sprung up, which I find to be great. And I'd like to call out a few of the journalists that I've seen on the ground and that have been doing just great work. Donovan Farley, Tuck Woodstock, Alex Zielinski. She's associated with the with Portland Mercury, but she's, you know, she's also great. Who else do we have? Sergio Olmos.
Yes.
Cory Alaya. So yeah, we have an incredible network of people on the ground. I think it is pretty loose in that I think we all retweet each other a lot, especially when we're, you know, live tweeting at the event. And we'll like run into each other and stuff. And I know that some journalists have like, you know, hooked up together and made sure like to keep each other safe. In one instance, I was being kettled and tear gassed, and I noticed another member of the press next to me holding his badge out, and we were getting chased down, and officers got within about 3 or 4 feet of us and pulled out their batons, so we were pretty stressed out, and we chanted together that it was our First Amendment right to report, you know, activities of the state, and we would chant that over and over again, holding out our press badges with our arms in the air, and it proved effective. I mean, I know it hasn't proved effective for other journalists on the ground, so I don't want to speak for everybody, but I think that there is safety in numbers, and there's also a lot of independent documentarians down there too, that I've met, who they're just doing great work. People have really sprung to the task, I think, especially at a time when journalism itself is suffering. I mean, like, that we live in a disinformation world where it's hard to know what to believe or who to trust if you're, you know, just a citizen and you're not there. So, yeah, I have been really impressed with how journalists have taken up the cause of making sure that this is accurately reported.
Well, Alex, I want to thank you for joining us this morning on the Abe and Joe Show, and also for your ongoing commitment to bring us the truth of what's transpiring here on our streets. Also, I would love to invite you back sometime in the to follow up on your work with the Citizens Oversight Committee, if you're willing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you next time.
Yeah, talk to you next time. Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. All right, that was KBOO's own Alex Solomon, volunteer journalist with the station. You can follow her work here on the air and online at kboo.fm. I would really love to hear what our listeners have to say about the situation here in town. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. You can also write to us online at facebook.com/AbeandJoe or send us a tweet at HonestAbe72. Joe, I think the conclusion is inescapable that law enforcement, as we understand it in this country, is not a sustainable model. And it's something that we have to strip down and rebuild, I think, if we're going to be anything resembling a sane civilization going forward.
Well, I absolutely agree. I mean, the historic role of the police in the United States, ranging from the slave catchers at crossroads in the South to people who crushed labor organizations in the North and elsewhere, that historic role is not just to support an establishment, but to support a fundamentally racist system. It has always been this way, and it continues to be that way, and until there is a real effort to create a well-educated, well-informed, and reasonable police structure, we're going to have this problem. And it's going to always get really bad when there is a serious disagreement, a serious crisis in the management of our society.
Yeah, it's just such a thorny question. And where to even begin? I think we can perhaps take some cues from the discussions happening around the country. There's been a couple major police unions, even, who have agreed to change the way they conduct business. I don't want to mischaracterize police unions across the board here, but it is an inescapable fact that a major obstacle in, first of all, preventing the sort of behavior that leads to unnecessary deaths, particularly among people of color at the hands of law enforcement, and as well as an obstacle to effectively following up and holding accountable the officers responsible, has been police unions across the country. They wield an enormous amount of power. We discussed that in the context of these protests on this program before. You can find story after story, even of mayors only being able to guarantee their election. I would guarantee is perhaps the wrong word, but only being able to be an acceptable candidate for office if they have the blessing of a police union. So it would seem to me that a place to begin is a radical reexamination of the role of police unions and the power that they're able to wield in these situations. And also, as different states and municipalities are now considering, we need to have in place a comprehensive spectrum of emergency response services. We just simply can't send a guy with a badge and a gun to every single 911 call, to every single disturbance. It's just not an effective way, first of all, to maintain sane civic order, but it seems an invitation for violence and even death. So at the very least, we're beginning to have those conversations in the context of the protests that have arisen since the death of George Floyd. But I have this sinking feeling, Joe, that when this all blows over, we're going to see more of the same. Because at the end of the day, law enforcement in this country exists to protect the prerogatives of the ruling class, full stop.
I think you're right. I mean, when we look at the history of policing, we see that its main function was to support an establishment. That was particularly notable and brutal in labor disputes in the North and in the suppression of efforts of African Americans to be free in the South. This is something that nobody was teaching in school when you and I were going to school, two different times, but it was always not emphasized. It was always presented as a kind of, we have police and they're good, no real analysis of their origin or their function in the order of the society. We need to begin to look at things realistically. We need to begin to teach our children a realistic history of the United States. Magical thinking, which characterizes everything from the idiocies of the president with his George Washington talk and so on, the magical thinking dominates a lot of our historic knowledge. And because of that, many, many people have been misinformed about our own history. There's a great history there, but it needs to be unwrapped and looked at in a reasonable way, and that is not what we get in our schools, as far as I know, from most teachers, and it's certainly not what's happening in our understanding of what's going on right now.
Yeah, you could say that we lately have been redefining the notion of American exceptionalism in a particularly tragic way, haven't we?
Yeah.
All right, we have a caller. Barth is on the line. Barth, thanks for joining us this morning. What's on your mind?
Always great. Well, lots of things are on my mind, but the big response here is the old cliche about, you know, when your only tool is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. If we want to have the change that is going to benefit everybody, including the police, we would have a wider discretionary base of responses. There was a pretty good article in a local press about the Eugene experiment, where they've been doing for years, other responders officially sanctioned and funded by the police department, who are mental health specialists and interpersonal specialists, people with some psychological and health training, and that they go out on the calls. You know, they get calls routed to them, and said only a few times has it been necessary to call for a police backup to, you know, help keep everybody safe. And I want to emphasize that that is the response they ask for when things are going sideways. You know, it's not stop the situation. It's not, you know, compound the effort and the force involved. It's to keep everybody safe. I think that the Portland police are classically, as Joe has talked about, been the bang first and you know, explain later if you have to. And this isn't a good working model. The police union does have a ton of power. It's difficult to separate the right to be an organized labor force overall from the difficulty of maintaining citizen oversight or even input into the police structure. So, you know, that's something that could be a whole show or two. And you guys have addressed some in the past. I'm starting to ramble a little bit, but this one is, it's very difficult because I believe that your earlier analysis of the facts holds out, that this guy didn't just pop off around and it happened to hit this guy in the head. You know, in larger crowd control situations, that has happened and can happen. It's not always deliberate, but this one seems pretty clear. So,
yeah, he drew a bead and he shot that kid in the head.
Right.
It,
you know,
it's,
you've got
really difficult
200 people in a crowded, you know, active situation, then, you know, stuff goes up and stuff comes down. But this didn't. So those are things that people should be made to answer for. And unfortunately, the power structure that, you know, the reinforcement that's coming down from the top over the last couple of years is saying, oh, you know, don't bother using your hand when you stuff them into the police car. And you know, if they hit their head, gee, that's too bad. And you know, I'm going to make sure that everybody is forced to listen. And, you know, if you have any legal problems later, let me talk about it. Those are paraphrasing the president. So it's difficult. And yes, it'd be really nice to know who these people are and what their actual, you know, job description is. So good luck with that. I'll just catch you guys off the air. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call.
Yeah, I want to emphasize that my suspicions are only that. It comes from what Trump says, and it's very difficult to read him from his bravado. I mean, his general demeanor and presentation is so full of lies, it's very difficult to parse it and figure out exactly what he's saying is going to be happening, and whether it's just talk or whether in fact implies a new way of policing or an ugly way of using the force that the state has. But I'm really suspicious of this new federal behavior. I have never, prior to these sets of events in this context of this great rebellion against policing, I have never before seen the kind of police behavior that we have begun to see, by the way, as many as several years ago in Portland, which has been a process in many, many cities, in some places in Philadelphia, in very many, many cities, with real violent consequences and people dying at the hands of the police with no actual consequence. So we need to examine the historic phenomenon of policing, we need to examine the contemporary phenomenon of policing, and we need to begin to think about the very rare occasion when a woman or a man with a gun is needed to go to help somebody in a situation on the road or elsewhere. We are making assumptions about our public being out of control, and we are not looking to find ways to calm, find ways to help, find ways to give people their honor and their self-respect. We rather look to policing to actually do the opposite, to rid people of their sense of autonomy and to destroy their sense of righteousness when they do have very often legitimate grievances and grief.
Let's go to Joe, who's standing by. Joe, good morning.
Morning, is that me?
Yeah, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hey, I want to put another voice in this. It seems like we're turning into an echo chamber here, where all the police are
there
bad.
There is that risk, yes.
And the whole situation is, you know, terrible. And Portland police are nasty, and the police union is corrupt. What are you going to do about a situation like we had recently at the Justice Center and also at North Precinct, when you have a mob barricading the doors and then trying to set fire to occupied buildings? What should the police response be in a situation like that?
That's a really good question. And I don't know the precise answer. I can say, though, that the response should not involve the use of lethal force against demonstrators, or even less than lethal force, as we've been discussing earlier.
Okay, when you say less than lethal, it's really, the term is actually less lethal, because the munitions
it's still an Orwellian term, however you want to parse it.
Yeah, it's a big difference, though, when you say less than lethal.
I want to acknowledge that that the behavior that is required to establish order in a chaotic mob situation, that behavior is very difficult. There has been a lot of research in the law enforcement community and in the general approach to these issues. And one of the things that has been clear, I think, is that there is a tendency in policing to think that the aggressive approach, like, for example, kettling, that is surrounding a crowd and not letting them leave until everyone gets identified, these activities are overkill. The police do need to be, and it is a very difficult job, they need to be two things. They need to be authoritative, that's their role, and they need to be compassionate. And that part of their role is very difficult in contrast to the other part. So one of the best things that could be done would be to parse the whole policing process into its various components. There are many, many police calls that are better answered by a social worker or somebody trained in other kinds of techniques than bang, bang, you're dead. And we're not we're not really acknowledging this. And I believe the reason why we don't acknowledge it is the history of policing in this country, a history that is ridden with attacks on labor, ridden with enormous racism, and all of that needs to be separated and pulled out and analyzed. There are many, and I want to make this clear, there are many police who are perfectly ordinary folk, men and women, doing their job as they see it and doing it properly. The command structure I cannot speak to, the union's role I think is pretty clear, but we are not understanding in this very difficult multi-task activity called policing that all of it would logically be separated into different kinds of activities in a more rational system.
Yeah, I think that was a little bit of a mushy answer, Joe. I got to step up for our caller right now. The caller is asking what specific tactics should law enforcement use when their physical headquarters, like the North Precinct, to use an example, is under attack and protesters are attempting to set it on fire. What specific tactics should they use in that situation?
Well,
Hang on. I don't want to crowd the caller out too much longer, but you know, I'll concede your point, Joe, that in a following a systemic review of policing and perhaps a reallocation of resources and personnel such as you're describing, we might have a situation where people don't feel the need to surround the precinct and try to set it on fire. But that's not the situation we're looking at now. So let's throw it back to the caller. Caller, what sort of tactics do you think are appropriate in that situation?
Well, obviously we've got a situation where we have a attempted arson and attempted murder. I mean, you have people inside a building that they barricaded the exits and then attempted to set fire to the building. So, you know, you have a lethal force situation on the part of the crowd toward innocent people, basically.
Yeah, I agree. So, I can't countenance or support attempts to set the North Precinct on fire or to physically harm officers. I think that's a transgression of the understanding of the First Amendment and what it means, what peaceful assembly is.
And I agree with you. I think the point is that the way in which it's structured is to encourage, and I don't know if this is deliberate, I don't think it is, but it's the way things are structured in law enforcement, in their training, and in the explicit activities that they're required to do in support of the establishment, that brings police into dangerous situations and requires them to use violence. Now, there are situations where an officer will have to use physical force, and there is always the advantage of numbers and technology. And I'm not going to argue that we should deprive the police of their numbers or their technology. It's just that it seems to me that the whole way that it's calibrated and thought about, and the way we see it on television, is about a violent response by the state to a violent criminal behavior. And that's not always what's going on. In fact, that's not generally what's going on. This is an unusual situation right now. It is indeed a history in Portland that needs to be looked at more realistically. When they kettle, when they use less lethal weaponry, when they believe rumors rather than having good intelligence, all of that is part and parcel of a process that comes out of a long historic role of the police, which most police don't even realize, which is a role of racism, a role of anti-labor advocacy, all kinds of stuff. And that can be cured. That can be addressed. That's not going to solve problems like when a crazy mob surrounds a police station. I'm not suggesting, and I don't believe it's true, that one should not do anything about that. And I don't want to be tarred with the idea that we should all be supporting behaviors that are physically dangerous to officers. The officers, whatever else they are human beings, and they have a right not to be in danger. So let's not mistake what goes on because of a historic set of events with what can be done in policing to establish law and order.
The caller, I want to thank you. That's a really telling question. I think it's one that needed to be posed in this context.
Well, it's a good question. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't really have a good answer for you. Perhaps in the situation we're looking at now, where you can count on night after night the presence of protesting crowds. I would maybe using the daylight hours to erect some sort of physical barrier to give the precinct a perimeter. I don't know. I really don't know what the best answer is in this situation, but I'm thankful that you asked the question. Let's move on to David. David, good morning.
Oh, yeah, morning. I'm kind of reminded that previous caller kind of raised a kind of a hairs on the back of my neck issue. If you paid attention, 20, 30 years ago, Mumia Abu-Jamal got put in prison. He was accused of killing a cop. And there's a later confession that came out of a guy who named Arnold Beverly, who claimed that he actually killed that cop and that he was a hitman hired by dirty cops. And the cop that was killed was a clean cop who was giving, he was an informant for the FBI against the Philadelphia cops, against the dirty Philadelphia cops. And they put a hit out on him and hired this Arnold Beverly to kill him. And then the Philly cops arrested Mumia as the foil for it. They got rid of a journalist and they got rid of a clean cop. So that it kind of raises this issue that we, the people, own that police station. The police are our employees, and nobody needs to burn down our building. We just need to make that building more of a community center. And I was going to raise an opportunity that shows up here. I wonder if Portland is using a software called Carbyne, C-A-R-B-Y-N-E. It's a software that Jeffrey Epstein helped design and that the 9/11 centers throughout the country are using this Carbyne, which has backdoor spying opportunities, and that this Carbyne also is used in the babysitting cameras, the doorbell cameras. So can you imagine the Jeffrey Epstein operation setting up so that there are backdoor operations to watch you change your baby? I mean, there are some creepy things going on, but if the 911 systems are being set up by Jeffrey Epstein's operation, maybe we can get a we the people, both sides of the aisle, opportunity to get that Carbyne system out of American policing, and then we can dismantle the police structures of all of these creepy security state blackmailing dirty cop operations and get back to a normal community center operation, which is what the police departments should be.
Well, I think what you're saying makes sense, except the question of normal in policing is a very different issue than what most of us would hope policing would be. And what we're being trained to believe is policing is what we all of us see on television every night. We need to have a better understanding of the function of law enforcement. We need to have a better appreciation of the limited role that the state needs to play, particularly when people are under stress and they are either dangerous to themselves or to others. We don't really have that. We have a very limitedly trained police force that are legitimately concerned for their own safety as they go into situations well-armed and very aggressive.
Well, have you ever heard of Gladio? It was a system that was put in basically after World War II. The Nazis going on the run created a system where the Nazis weren't just allowed to escape and go to a basement somewhere. They were allowed to set up government in Argentina and Uruguay and Paraguay and actually the CIA as well. It was called Operation Paperclip. And so apparently Gladio is still in effect post 9/11. You know, this whole idea of the snooping system of total information awareness and Oliver North kind of secret operations that were actually bringing cocaine into the country and privatized prisons and asset seizure and creating a privatized police system that doesn't serve us. It basically serves the corporate state. So, you know, Andy of Mayberry was at You're right. Andy of Mayberry basically hasn't existed in America, but he tried to show us what it could be. And, some of us still have some memory of what policing could be.
I think we're going to leave it there. Thank you very much, David, sure. for the call. Let's try and get quickly to Robbie before the end. Robbie, got to make it fast.
I'm afraid Robbie has vacated the line.
All right. Well,
Robbie saw the writing on the clock, as it were.
Well, thank you, everybody, who took part in the conversation today. I want to urge people who are out there protesting to please be safe, not just from COVID-19, but from less lethal projectiles that might be flying through the air. I'm grateful that you're out there. We need you out there, but we also need you to be safe and healthy and whole. So please do take good care. We also want to thank Alex Solomon of KBOO for her journalism during this time and for appearing on the show today. Joe, do you have anything to say before we're out?
No, except that it's too bad that in our culture, in our society, we live with a mythology of the police rather than the reality of the police. And then so many of us are either overreactive or totally unaware of what's going on and what the history of all of this is, because the history is the key to unwinding policing as it's currently done, so that it becomes more humane, more effective, and that's an important point, and is not only about guns and bulletproof vests and less lethal weaponry.
Indeed. And we'll leave it there. Thank you, everyone. This has been the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show on KBOO 90.7 FM, and we'll talk to you again next week.
When I thought of this term, white fragility, the fragility part, we're fragile in that we can barely tolerate the slightest challenge, right? I mean, just the suggestion